W2VL repeater.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
WA2CDL, this is KC2JRQ calling. WA2CDL, KC2JRQ calling.
KKND.
Yes, Ricky.
Yeah, volume is down. Hard to make out right now.
Yeah, sorry, I'm replying on an HD. I just heard someone come over with a radio check. Not, but on my regular rig. Sorry about that.
Alright, well, you're making the repeater, but obviously with a lower signal than you normally do.
Another station,
all right, again, Jonathan, the audio is down a little bit, so it's a little hard to understand everything that you're saying, but it's working, if that was your question.
No, I didn't have a question. There was another station that had a radio check, and I was replying to him, telling him that he was a bit down in the north, that's all. Sorry, my audio level was different.
Oh, that was better. But yeah, I also thought I heard another station in there, but then he just didn't come back. KTKND.
W2VL repeater.
ZSE, how are you? This is K1AMR.
Hey, Jonathan. Just heading out to pick up dinner.
Ah, so is that a long drive? Hopefully not. Where are you picking up dinner?
Oh, it's local. Only about 5 minutes from the house.
Sounds good. I'm just relaxing here after doing a bunch of stuff around the house and have the radio on and heard your call come across.
Yep. No, I've... What time is it anyway? It's almost 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, no, I was talking to Richie when I was around earlier. And Lou. We've been doing little bits and pieces of trying to straighten things up, and he seems to have gotten the echo link back working very well.
Excellent, great. Yeah, good to hear. Yeah, I think I heard some of that conversation. Sounds like it's working better now. That's good to hear. Going anywhere?
Yeah, Yeah, we're trying to reorganize things as it were. Have a little bit more time to contribute to that.
Excellent. I was on the Plainview 440 machine today as well, which was working actually really, really well. Had a good conversation on it with a person in Queens who was getting in very easily on HD. So that side of things will seem to be working well.
Yeah. I'm going to sneak out of here. I just pulled into the parking lot, and I've got to go inside in about 30 seconds. So I will speak to you a little bit later. K1AMR, WDQCSA.
Sounds good. K1AMR will be clear. 73s.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
I hit the dial on the radio before. I wasn't sure that you were copying me.
Yeah, I was over on 375. I switched back just now. I said, hello there.
Yeah, that was bad. I even had my hearing aids in and didn't hear that. So, sometimes, I mean, there's no doubt that they make a big difference, but they also hear too much, you know?
Yep. Reminds me, I had to get Billy a call and tell him that Lou put the isolator in.
Yeah, I heard you talking to Lou before about the antennas. It seems to me, again, that we were given a 900 megahertz link by a company that had some system, just the signal thing, memory's gone. But anyway, yeah, if there's something 30 feet up in the air, it's probably pretty good for what we need.
Yeah. You know what? Let me give you a really quick phone call before I go in the house. WDB2ZSA.
K2KNB.
Looking for a radio check, testing out my ID 52. I'm looking for a radio check on my new ID 52.
W2WIL, your radio check is pretty clear, and I'm in Suffolk County, W2WIL.
Oh, awesome. You're right next door. I'm in Oakland. Pleasure to meet you.
Same here, W2WIL. I haven't been on the radio since probably about 2 years.
Excellent. Same here. 73s, I'm listening.
test.
This is KD2TYN. Anyone on the air for radio check?
Immediately when I was testing, you sound pretty good.
Oh, so do you.
Second pass, W2WIL, you guys both sound very, very good.
Excellent. Thank you very much. 73 is listening.
Thank you.
I guess everybody's ready for tonight. Thanks, KD2OGB, standing by for the TechNet.
Limark TechNet tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater.
That's time.
W2WAL, you have about 10% noise in the background. Volume's a little bit low. Any second now, we're going to start the technical net talk.
Thank you for that. The clarification is W2WAL. I have a cheap radio, but thank you for that radio check.
Okay, very good. Welcome everyone, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy and I am net control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. It's been going strong for about 40 years now, mostly under the direction of Dick, K2RIW. Fortunately, Dick became a silent key about a year and a half ago. So we are continuing on in his memory. As always, I like to give people a list of links, so I will drop for a second, and I will give you the appropriate link. Okay, if you need to reach me, and you can't reach me via the repeater, email is an excellent way. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. That would be either for mailbag questions, or if you would like to discuss a topic, or you would like to hear a topic discussed, or we collect technical puzzles so that we can kind of tease each other's brain and force us to remember things that we've forgotten a long time ago, or learn new things. Also, if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some NASA or space-related information, you can email me or you can email him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. Also, I have a link page with a bunch of interesting links. Some of them are more visual than they are oral, so they don't lend themselves much to discussion on a radio, but I still find them fascinating. They're available. There are some interesting science articles that I've read throughout the week that we may discuss later on during the technical net, but in case we don't, they're available on my link page, and we keep those up 24/7. I just made a nice new clean link for 2022. The one for 2021 still exists, and for 2019 and 2018, and you can get to all of them via the links on the page. So if you type in roy.ac2gs.com, that'll take you to our nice new clean link page. Also, we have a chat room available. You can go to Limark's own webpage, find the link, and log on. Or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. That will bring you to the chat room. I stream audio in case someone was trying to listen to the Echo link, and unfortunately the Echo link seems to be down tonight. You can always type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com. And that'll give you the audio stream that I provide 24/7 to any interested person. Also, I'd like to remind everyone of my KT2NJR's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv. He keeps there archives of the technical net that go as far back as September 2006. He's had over a million visitors and make it a million and one. It's a very interesting place and a great archive for the wisdom of amateur radio operators who moved away from the metropolitan area and who have passed away, unfortunately. So take a look at that. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay, it's going to be a usual session. I heard a few people tuning up and checking on their signal, so I hope there's going to be a lot of participation in this, our first technical net of 2022. We're going to ask people to, if they have any technical questions, preferably amateur radio related at first. I'd like those people, if they can, to kind of go to the top of the list since this is an amateur radio-based technical net. But we allow any other questions of a scientific or medical nature. So I will ask for any questions. People will then submit their first name, their call sign. I'll write it down on a list. And after the people with amateur radio questions or technical aspects or topics or statements or comments, then anyone with any kind of scientific question, you know, we'll try our best to help answer, and people listening will help as well. That should take us to about 10:15, and Paul will give us the SpaceNet report, which will take us to about 11 p.m., and I will return, put a bow on it, wish you well, and call it a week. So if my computer, my radio, the repeater, the antennas, and all the sundry things that are required to keep this working continues to work, that's the plan for tonight. So, with that in mind, I will drop for a second and ask for people with any questions of a technical nature to give me your first name and call sign.
I got two things for you, Roy, KD2OGB.
NY2H with a system status.
KD2UDU supporting. NY2H, questions? Subjects.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu, amateur radio statement.
KD2 VHD, Jim, ham radio question.
Check 1-2, hello, 3-30, version 3.7.1.
I got you.
You hear me?
I hear you.
You hear me on the link?
No, W2BC, listening.
Okay, just put it in. I think I spelled his name wrong. What did you have? FR what?
It sounds like the machine came back, guys. Roy, are you in there?
Hopefully I am. Hopefully you hear me now.
It's FRIDDMAN. Friedman.
Roy, I hear you. I'm on the phone with Andy, and yeah, everything came back up. I don't know what's going on up there.
Well, is it possible that they don't hear us, that something happened with the link as well?
Okay, Roy, you're coming in good. What's going on here now? Back to you, Roy. AC2GS, WS21.
Okay, this is AC2GS. I'm in good old Brooklyn. I'm transmitting to Glen Oaks. I hope that both Glen Oaks and Selden is hearing us again. The repeater, the Glen Oaks repeater apparently went pear-shaped about seven minutes ago, and the guys brought it back. So, Lou, any idea what happened?
Lou's on here somewhere. He was on before, so I was like waiting for him to come back, so we'll have to wait for him. I'm going to be standing by, and in fact, I'm going to QSY back to Glen Oaks.
Yeah, I'm here. Stand by. All right. We did not do anything. Andy's out eating, but he was able on his HC to hear the link radio working, and by the time he said that, I was testing so he could hear me, and I heard Glen Oaks come back. We did not do a thing. So I don't know what's going on. If there was a temporary power outage there, I have no clue. We didn't do anything. It was on, it was off, and now it's on again.
Okay, so we'll put it down as an attack of gremlins, and we'll hope that they don't attack us anymore.
Did you manage to get anybody marked down before it went down?
Yes. Craig, I got you. I got Lou, who was going to tell us the status of the repeater. I got Wesley. I got Rich, W2BZ, and I got Jim, KD2BHD.
Oh, we're all here waiting for you, KD2OGB.
Okay, just waiting to make sure that the repeater is nice and stable. I don't want to give it another Kunahara and question the possibility of a future. So, once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net with a slight confusing interruption, but we are back. So, Craig, you told me you have two questions or two topics tonight. Please, what are they tonight?
I want to get very long answers out of them. I got snow duty tomorrow morning in Hicksville. First one, my computer. This is kind of an important one. Yesterday, I'm on Roblox playing with my friends while chatting on Discord, just minding my own, and without warning, keyboard locks up, mouse locks up, computer completely hard freezes. Hit the reset button and is fine after that. What's going on? I haven't had this happen in like a while.
Well, that doesn't really lend itself to a quick answer. You know, there are about 1,000 different things that could interrupt the operating system's multitasking and freeze the ability it has to pull different flags and figure out where mouse positions and keypads are. I assume when you say you reset it, that you did the Alt-Delete-Control and went to that lovely little screen and then clicked out of it and everything came back? Is that what you meant by reset?
No, I did what's called a soft reset. I've got to use my words better. Basically, it was a hard lock, and it's frozen, mouse is frozen, keyboard's frozen, everything. It just freezes and no blue screen, just frozen. So I hit the soft reset button next to the power button. Takes a little bit to reset and was working fine after that.
AC2GS. Well, again, I can't kind of pull exactly what caused your problem. It could have been an interaction with numerous third-party drivers or some Microsoft driver and a third-party driver. I would probably, once you were finished, to do a complete cold reset just to be on the safe side and see if it happens again. If it does, you have to look further into is your memory working right? Is your operating system working right? Like I said, unfortunately, you know, that's like saying that you had a twitch. There's about 3,000 different things that'll give you a twitch. So, I just kind of reboot it to turn the power off, let it just kind of sit there for a little while, reboot it up, and check to see if it happens again.
One of my guys suggested, sorry about that. One of my guys suggested in Task Manager to go to the events and maybe see if something came up over there. Another idea, hang on a second. Another idea might be to, what is it? Another idea, he might be thinking that it could be a corrupted program perhaps, maybe like a scrambled program that might have caused the lock. So I'll have to try to see what it is. I might be able to look at that in the Task Manager, because I don't think my, whatever that Z word is, the CAM program that shows like your CPU and everything, I'm not sure if that can show that, so I'll do that in the Manager.
AC2GS. Well, I don't think you're going to get much out of that because those things don't record results. They give you somewhat, with a slight delay, with a latency delay, real-time errors. So if you had the taskbar open and selected to a task and you saw when the screen locked up, theoretically, if it updated the screen and you saw that all of a sudden it was taking up 100 CPU percent cycles, then you might know something. But after the fact, if you open the taskbar, everything's going to look fine. The same thing with a corrupted program. A corrupted program would probably either just crash the program or crash the operating system. It's not really going to leave a message behind in your task monitor. Task monitor just kind of, like I said, monitors somewhat real-time use of the system, memory, graphics processor, CPU, and what have you. It's not going to record things if something locks up, especially if that lockup also locks up the error-generating message part of the operating system.
Maybe next week, if I'm available, I could try to get a little more information out of this, but I'll try to figure something out. The other one might be a maybe answer. I still have my Canon T5. I don't really want to hold on to it. The thing, though, is I already tried this by uploading a file, and it's not storing it in the Excel file or whatever it's called. How do I get the shutter count on my camera, since that's important when you're selling it like a car?
Okay, that's another thing that since I don't have a Canon camera, I don't exactly know how that operating system works. Most cameras do have a manufacturer's reboot situation. So if you Google something like that, it should tell you the proper buttons to press and things to do to have it reset all the way to initial factory conditions. And then it should be in a kind of, as far as the software is concerned, as new configuration.
Technically, no. It's a DSLR. It's got a, it has a built-in shutter on it, and that can't be reset because that's a fixed parameter. Everything else can be reset, but that's a fixed parameter. You can't reset that counter to zero. I just want to try to view it so that I can take note on how old the camera is and how much longer it might work until.
Okay, it doesn't have an about screen at the, you know, one of the menu selections. Usually, if they're going to keep records of how many clicks, they're going to stick it in some file or more likely some screen. So have you Googled to see if there's a place on the menu where you can pull out that information and make it viewable?
It's not really that simple. I wish it could be, but they make it so hard to get the shutter count. It's like you need external software, or you got to plug it into the computer to get it to show.
Well, yeah, I can sort of understand older digital SLRs and such. We're not, and Canon's not the greatest as far as the software designers, so I could see where they're trying to make more money by charging people to get a copy of the software. Whereas most modern mirrorless cameras these days, they kind of throw in the software for free. It's one of the feature sets. But offhand, I don't know. If it's not designed to just kind of give it to you on an about screen in the menu, and it's only set to download through a proprietary connector or proprietary Canon software. Other than searching the internet for a copy of that software, I don't know what to tell you.
KT2R1.
Yes, David.
I've got something here. I don't know if it's useful. It says here, how do I find the shutter count on my Canon T5? Plug the camera into the computer and select camera settings, remote shooting, from the EOS utility window. Shutter count will appear at the top next to the battery level indicator. That's what I got here.
Okay, David, I assume that software is free?
It doesn't say, but, you know, I would think it is. You can get a Canon utility from the Canon website, What I would do is I would just say Canon utility for Canon, I'll say utility for Canon T5, and it should take you to that software download.
Well, here's my question. Is it Mac or PC? I think it's going to be Mac.
Well, it says here plug the camera into the computer. It doesn't say Mac or PC.
I would assume a company like Canon has software for both operating systems.
Well, I have a Canon EOS 5D Mark II, and it works with a Mac.
There a little bit.
I would be astounded. I am pretty sure that you could find a PC version that will work.
I wonder if it's EOS Mark II that you have?
What I can get. And also, I got the 5DSR and the SL1. I don't have just the T5. I'm surprised you actually expected I had the T5 since that's what I want to get rid of.
Good. I think you can probably get the shutter count on any of their cameras.
Yeah, as soon as this is done, I'm going to go grab the MacBook. I'll look it up real quick and then I'm... I think that should be everything, so thank you guys. AC2GS, Net Control, KD2OGB.
Okay, very good, Greg. I wish you good luck with that. If you have a chance, future technical nets, come back, tell us how it works, or, of course, if you have any other future problems, you know where to find us. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. I'm hearing some doubling, and sounds like people are having conversations. I hope we don't have that problem with the New Jersey repeater kind of bleeding over to us. But nevertheless, next on my list tonight is Wesley, M2XJN. What's your question or topic for tonight, Wesley?
A few short. One is the VNA Nano Duo that has... And I was trying to compare it with the professional VNA vector network analyzer. The VNA Duo is $60, $70. And it's a quite nice tool. I was trying to find out what is the problem with that, if there is any. And I think you, Roy, have your own opinion about it, so... back to you before.
Yeah, I think it is a great inexpensive way to check out the concept of vector network analyzers, and for the purposes of almost all amateur radio operators, it kind of suffices. You know, it's possible that it might not be the greatest device to tune a duplexer for a repeater. Might not quite have the dynamic range you would want, but generally speaking, for the price point, it's impossible to go wrong. I mean, I have two other vector network analyzers. They're both one port. This one is two ports, so it allows you to do other things that cost significantly more. I have a Rig Expert AA600 that cost me $500 and change. I have a array solution, 1/4, that costs about $400 or $500. They're both wonderful pieces of equipment, but, you know, for $60. So, you know, I could understand, whereas someone would tell me, I can't spend $500 on a glorified electronic toy. You know, for $60, you probably can. And with that $60, you can do a heck of a lot of things. You can't do the same things that you can with a Rohde & Schwarz $10,000 V&A, but then pretty much none of us need a $10,000 Rohde & Schwarz V&A, except for people like WA2CDL and people who maintain repeaters and do other kinds of interesting stuff that most of us don't do. And as I mentioned in an email to you, most inexpensive, you know, under $1,000 V&As all use square wave signal generators, and so we'll have the same problems that the Nano V&A has.
I don't hear you.
Well, the feeling is mutual. I didn't hear anything that you said. It was all just blank. I don't know if your mic has a problem. I don't think so. I don't know if the repeater has a problem. I don't think so. Someone out there with a twitchy push-to-talk button finger might have a problem.
I ask you, based on your opinion, what is the difference between using a square wave instead of sine wave?
Well, okay. Effectively, for the things that 99.9% of amateur radios use, it won't have any effect. If you are going a multi-class amplifier stage circuit, you can get some feedback from the harmonics due to the square wave. But again, almost no one I know uses it for testing amplification circuits for the frequency of the local oscillators built into some of them. That was the test circuit that guy was kind of showing in that YouTube that you linked it to. But for all intents and purposes, if you are checking coaxial cables, transmission lines, antennas, it's immaterial whether you're feeding it a square wave or a sine wave.
Okay. So you can use the car, but you can use the bicycle, right? And you're going to go in even direction for the given distance. What's the difference?
I'm not quite sure what the question is. If you have $10,000-$20,000 to spend on a deluxe model, it can do some things that better that most hams won't do. Otherwise, for the 99.99% of the things that hams are going to use a vector network analyzer for, a square wave generator is fine. And as I mentioned before, if you say that, you know, if you look at it and say, well, I would like a sine wave generator, I'm not going to spend $60. I'll go buy a Rig Expert AA600 for $500,000. You'll still have a square wave generator because it's a lot less expensive. You don't have to worry about linearity issues, so it drives the price of all the components down, and fundamentally for the use that type of V&A gets, it has no appreciable deficit.
Well, a nano V&A covers 10 kilohertz to 1.5 gigahertz. It gives you the fairly simple way to check impedance and SWR on the wired antenna systems and experiment with it. The only difference that I see is that if you have a sine wave, you have a linear way of sampling. actually what is VNA is the generator that is sweeping the given range of the frequencies, and there is the receiver that is actually receiving those frequencies and drawing it on the screen. So if you have a square wave, the width of that square wave is not traceable. It's just exactly the same. So it's up to you how you have a duty cycle set. Enter it, Gia.
Okay, but effectively it doesn't impact in most people's resolution for their SWR. Not too many people want a 1 hertz increment of an SWR curve. They want to know how a full antenna is operating across the band that it's cut to. All things being equal, you can set these inexpensive VNAs for a different granularity of resolution of frequencies, but up until a point it becomes a point of diminishing returns.
Yeah, I agree with you. The literature that I found about it says that nano VNA fails above 300 megahertz, so it doesn't even go to the upper ham radio bands on VHF, and it does not really perform as well, but for our application it is a quite good way. Now, do you remember those MFJ devices that were used before for tuning our antenna? I didn't use any one of them, but if you remember, what is the difference that you see right now by using nano VNA and those that were years ago produced by MFJ?
Well, it depends. I mean, very early antenna analyzers is what they would call them, because they weren't vector network analyzers as far as I'm aware. And all they really were impedance bridges. So you would adjust the settings and calculate the impedance value of whatever you plugged into it. And some of them wouldn't even give you the polarity. So you wouldn't know if the impedance was capacitive or inductive. I think they still sell them. They're the lowest priced objects. I would be amazed if anyone actually buys them anymore, again, because of the price of things like nano VNA. If you're inexpensive solution to a problem that just gets you by, they were useful. There were a lot of old timers who depended upon those as their antenna analyzers, but that group are not VNA. So you're far better off with a VNA that gives you far more information in a much easier to read. Those things had knobs and dials, and it was sort of a mess. I never actually used one. I just looked at pictures of them and felt bad for people who had to use them much.
Yeah, the comparison that I found online between professional Hewlett-Packard VNAs states that nano VNA appears to perform very well, and there is something that is better than nothing, and that would be nano VNA. So at least you don't have to hassle that much. I don't remember that. That was a long time ago that I dealt with MFJ. But I believe this is a good tool. If somebody wants to perform the tuning of the antenna, I'll find out what's going on. The only problem is you cannot do it online. So that means you cannot really perform the antenna measurement when you have it connected to your radio. Enter XGA.
Well, Well, yeah, by nature, I'm not quite sure if there's any VNA that's really designed to take full power. I mean, you can give it a teeny tiny bit of power because it's just not designed to deal with a lot of watts, but it's meant to be off of your transmitter. I don't really see where that's a terrible problem. I mean, there is a slight degree in resonance shifting as the power output goes up and elements heat up, and there's slight deviation in capacitance and inductance. Usually I don't find that that's a problem. You don't really have to tune it that tightly, I found, at least in practical experience at high power. If you the idea is you're going to get some kind of a curve. Will the curve shift by, 100 hertz or 200 hertz if you go from microwatts to kilowatts? Possibly. But in a 3,000 hertz signal, does that make a difference? I don't think so.
I agree with you. There is some information saying that it doesn't go good for low VLF, very low frequencies. So for our guys who want to go at 131 kilohertz and lower of that frequency, this thing is not good. I believe, yeah, if you have a square wave and you have such a low frequency, the square wave is simply too long, too fat. Too fat. The square wave is too fat for you to get the information. If you have had a sinusoidal wave, you can get any point on it. So, not good for VLF and not good over 300 megahertz. And to XGA.
Okay, I mean, that's possible. There's also other factors. What you're depending upon is the degree of linearity of the signal generator. They have a bandwidth of their own. They don't go down to zero. Some are better at lower frequencies than others. But again, you're selecting for a very, very small subset of a subset of a subset. There's probably a couple of hundred guys working on low frequency who could use a nice VNA. Whereas there's probably tens of thousands of hams who, one of the big questions is, why does my antenna not work? Well, you plug it into a VNA, you look at the curve, and you can figure it out rather quickly. Every so often, I'll have someone send me a screenshot of their VNA that shows that the damn thing isn't anywhere near resonant. You just point out the fact that there's no resonance there. It might be in a different band, or it might not be anywhere, but it offers, to me personally, a very cost-effective visual sensibility of what's going on. You don't have to sit with Smith's curves. You don't have to plug in equations. You just look at the curve. You see where the minimum is. You see if it's anywhere near 50 ohms of nominal impedance. And you kind of get the feel for whether you have a resonant antenna or you have a doorknob.
Okay, the next subject that I have is magnetron and some of the application of the magnetron that was the sulfur lamp, if some people remember. Shortly, we could say that magnetron was invented by Lee DeForest in 1873. Actually, no, that was in 1906, and it was the name Odeon was not popular at that time. He was also the father of triode vacuum tube. So we may say that at that time everybody was experimenting. We had the Tesla time and a few others, and this guy was four times of a rich like a hell, and four times almost having nothing to eat. So everybody was suing everybody. AT&T and General Electric and some other companies, and that was the crazy time. Hey, I have sent you two links. One is a cavity magnetron, and the other one is sulfur lamp. Both of them are in Wikipedia. And interesting application is the sulfur lamp. The only addition to the magnetron is we're using magnetron in our microwaves right now. And there was one particular the novelty to magnetron that was the cavity magnetron. It actually looks like a plain piece of metal with the holes in it and nothing apart from that. There is no grid on it. It just cuts the nano.
Wesley?
Yes.
Well, I don't know where that email is. I don't remember seeing it unless you tucked it in with other stuff in the same email, and I didn't notice it. As far as I'm aware, Lee DeForest did not invent the magnetron. The magnetron was developed by a guy named Albert Hull. You know, I mean, there was some work on cavity magnetrons. That's a guy, Hans Gerdian, I think. But not Lee DeForest. Lee DeForest invented the third element for a tube. Effectively, it was a triode. He labeled it and sold it as an Audion tube. The last time I brought this up, I really annoyed some guy who really was a fan of Lee DeForest, because Lee DeForest didn't have the faintest idea how a triode worked. He took Edwin Armstrong to court, in which Edwin Armstrong was sworn in and gave a complete description of how the Audion tube worked, whereas Lee DeForest didn't have a clue. When Lee DeForest first developed it, he put the gate on the outside of the tube, outside of the vacuum. So I got a lot of complex emotions as far as Lee DeForest is concerned. He is probably the greatest litigant in electronic history.
Yes, the people called Lee DeForest the charlatan. Some of them, because of his 300 patents, call him a genius. The use of magnetic fields as a means of control to flow of electrical current was spurred by the invention of Audion by the Lee Forest in 1906. And there was the guy Paul and General Electric Research Lab. That was not General Electric from America. That was General Electric Research Lab in England. They began the development of magnetrons to avoid Forest patents. And there is a special note that the explanation of that is in the book, The Invention of Cavity Magnetron, and its introduction into Canada and USA. That's the French La Physics au Canada, November 201. So the General Electric Research Lab began development of magnetrons to avoid Forest patents, but those were never completely successful. So other experiments pick up on Hull's work, and the key advance to use the two cathodes that was introduced in Hagen in Germany 1924. Now, if we're talking about two cathodes or two anodes, those were also tried in magnetron, but they were also tried in tubes. If you, many of ham radios, especially all the ham radios, they were using the lamps, and some of the American lamps had the two anodes, and they were triodes. And sometimes we would tend to connect those two grids and two anodes together. If anybody remember that time. Okay. So, if we're talking about the holes, we cannot forget that Hull's work was only available due to the General Electric Research Lab. He's from England. Different General Electric, not our General Electric. And if not that, the Hull will never do that. I mean, he would do it, but he would never be famous for it. Okay, if you have any notes to that, Dr. Roy.
Well, I really haven't looked deeply into magnetrons as a subject. I just, once again, Lee DeForest was a highly litigious guy who was playing with an already understood a vacuum tube rectifier. They had already discovered, other people had discovered, that you can rectify current through an anode and a cathode. Fortunately for him, he lucked upon getting a third piece of wire outside of the tube, on the outside surface, which he then applied a slight positive charge and noticed an amplification effect. He patented up and down and all around and tried to make it the basis, I understand, of an amplification circuit to broadcast AM radio. I think he was going to broadcast opera or something. And it was a complete disaster because the gain of a triode with the grid outside the vacuum is not very good. Other people figured that out and put it inside the vacuum. Other people made it even better. They all tried to get a patent extension because of their modifications. He took them to court and he got all the money. Edwin Armstrong took a flying leap out of a window back in the 50s. The guy who invented FM radio modulation, super regenerative circuits, super heterodyne circuits, and perfected the Audion Tri-02. And, you know, all he got was a splat on the ground. So, I don't know. Different people have different perspectives. There are some people who love and adore Lee DeForest, the father of radio, the grandfather of television. I don't know. I think there was something a little bit off of that guy. I think he was a great grifter, and he had a good sense of lawyers.
WB2EAV.
Yes, Ed.
I hope I'm making it okay, because I really don't want to use the outdoor antenna, which means I have to be outdoors tonight.
No, surprisingly, you are full quieting right now.
I just tuned in late, and I just heard the most incredible mishmash. You know Billy Joel's song, We Didn't Start the Fire? It was like a radio version of that. Wesley's talking about magnetrons, you're talking about Lee DeForest and the triodes, and then the death of Edward Howard Armstrong, basically a lifetime later. I don't know where to start on this, but I can pick any of those topics and expound endlessly.
Oh, that was by connection of the person. So we took one person from as a subject, and this person was connected to the triad and to the magnetron as well.
One author I read said Lee DeForest may have not even really known what he was doing, but he did invent the triode. Maybe not a good one, but count it as a triode. The magnetron was invented by the British Randall and Boot, were the two engineers working under the aegis of Dr. Edmund G. or Taffy Bowen. I've read extensively about this. And basically, this was the very beginning of World War II, and Bowen found out that the British were all tied up in the war and didn't have any manufacturing resources available. So he actually took one of their prototype magnetrons to Washington, D.C. to see if the Americans could manufacture them. But this was all in World War II,